You're listening to The Dollop. This is a bi-thing American history podcast. Each week, I, Dave Anthony, read a story to my friend.
Gareth Reynolds, who has no idea what the topic is going to be about. So, not sure. Or has no idea how the intro is going to go.
Nailed it. I just saw a large mammal. I think it was a seal?
No.
That was not a seal. It was seal-shaped.
It's a cat.
That's a cat.
It's a cat named Jose.
Should cats have necks?
Should linebackers have necks? Should top athletes have necks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, they should. Well, a lot of them don't. And so that's the same with cats. Some athletic cats.
Uh-huh.
He's like the Jack Kangaroo. He's not fat.
Well, he's really slowly going into a box right now.
Yeah.
Nope, he's going over it. Oh, he's crushing
it. That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
That was so sad. Uh-huh. He's so heavy, he crushed the box. Now it's just flat.
Dude, it's not. You're making it sound like it's a taped up box. It's propped up there for him to have fun with it. So, of course, it collapses.
Clearly not. No. He didn't know.
No, he does know. That happens 11 times a day, what you just saw.
Oh.
You didn't witness something special. It's not sad.
That was sad.
No, SeaWorld sad.
God, you want a little hit of dude?
I'll do one bump.
People say this is funny.
Not Gary Gera.
Is Dave okay?
Someone or something is tickling people.
Is it for fun?
And this is not going to become the tickling podcast.
Okay.
You are Queen Fakey of Made Up Town.
All hail Queen Shit of Liesville.
A bunch of religious virgins go to mingle.
And do what?
Pray.
Hi, Gary.
No.
Nicely done, my friend.
No. No.
We're brought to you in part by Policy Genius. Look, if someone relies on you for financial support, whether it's a child or an aging parent or even a business partner, you need life insurance. Life insurance, it gives you peace of mind. So if something happens to you, your loved ones, they're going to have a financial cushion to pay for things like rent, mortgage, loans, education, just everything, daily expenses. And usually life insurance gets more expensive as you age. So it start a policy soon rather than, you know, waiting on it. So look, head over to policygenius.com and answer a few questions about yourself. And in just a few minutes, you can work out how much life insurance coverage you need. And then you compare personalized quotes to find your best price. You could save 50% or more on life insurance by comparing quotes with Policy Genius. And they work for you. So Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies. So you can trust them to offer unbiased help and advocate for you at every step until you're covered. They don't add on extra fees. They don't sell your info to third parties. So head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. We are brought to you in part by Zen Business. Look, a lot of people right now, the great resignation is on. They're like, they're out of their jobs. They're like, I don't want to do this anymore. I want more control over my life. I want a better life. I don't want a boss man telling me what to do. And so a lot of people are starting their own business. Zen Business is very, very helpful. They got an all-in-one platform. It guides you as a new entrepreneur through all the stuff you have to go through to get it going, an LLC or whatever you're going to set up. Got a super easy pricing structure, starts as low as $49. And then look, they're not going to hit you with a bunch of hidden fees. It's all very straightforward. What they say is what it is. They have a very fast and simple business formation for LLC and other business structures. Worry-free compliance and annual filings, so you can stay in good standing with the state. You can secure an employee ID number so you can open a bank account, hire employees, protect your person, all that stuff. I wish I had Zen Business when I started my business. It would have freed up all that time I spent on paperwork and all that stuff, so I could have just focused on the business. So look, Zen Business has helped hundreds of thousands of people get their business off the ground by guiding them every step of the way and making it easier to launch a successful business. Get started today for as low as $49 at zenbusiness.com/dollop. That's zenbusiness.com/dollop.
See, he's not even looking at you. Not even looking at you.
Doesn't respond to its calls.
Dude, he's not a seal.
1820!
All right, 1820.
And 1829.
How is that possible? What is happening?
Cousins Philip Arnold and John Slack were born in Hardin County, Kentucky.
All right. What are their names? Slack?
Philip Arnold and John Slack.
John Slack, okay.
I knew Charlie Slack in high school. He beat me up.
Oh.
Near Elizabethtown.
Okay.
It's close to where Abraham Lincoln was born.
I know that. You don't need to tell me where Abraham Lincoln was
great
born.
Great people came from this
Elizabethtown. Yeah. Abraham Lincoln, this guy, the other guy.
They were raised as farmers, but both joined the military to fight in the Mexican-American War.
Okay.
For the Americans.
Okay. A war we're planning on revisiting soon.
Yep, looks like it.
Yeah.
Slack claimed he walked all the way to Mexico to join up.
Okay. Wait, he was on the Mexican side?
No, he's in Kentucky, and he said he walked all the way down to Mexico to get involved.
Sorry, as just a logistical flag, if I may throw a logistical flag.
You may.
I have many. Mm-hmm. Why would you go to Mexico to join the American side?
Well, I guess he might have walked to the border where we did go into Mexico. It wasn't like we were...
But he talked to somebody before he went into Mexico.
Maybe. Or maybe he walked down and went, hey, you guys, I'm going to fight with you guys. And they're like, come on, get a thing. A hatchet or whatever.
It's not a game of kickball. It feels like there's more hoops to jump through.
So he might be lying. That's totally acceptable. That's totally acceptable to think in this story.
I'm not picking up my logistical flag, which is telling.
Arnold joined the fight a couple of months later. They both saw action and were honorably discharged.
Okay.
Slack was let out a year earlier, and he went back to Elizabethtown, where he became a constable. Gold was discovered in California in 1848, and that set off the gold rush. You knew that.
Dave, I know that.
Slack left his job and headed west. And then Cousin Arnold, that's not his first name, but I'm calling him Arnold. Cousin Philip went straight after being discharged in Mexico. So he's like, okay, you're out. And he went, okay, I'm going to go
there. So they both get in on the gold rush business.
Bingo.
The bingo business?
They both reached the gold fields and mined with very little luck. Early in the 1850s, they happened to find each other, and they stuck together. So they didn't even know. I guess back then, they didn't have cell phones or whatever.
Okay, yeah, right. Wait, you're doing this too?
Holy shit, how long you been here? 4 years!
How's it going?
Bad.
Same.
I wish I never left.
I know!
They partnered in hydraulic mining in Yuba County and met a man named Asbury Harpending.
Okay. Sorry. His name is Asbury Harpending?
Asbury Harpending. I think it's like a
it's like
English situation.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a musical jam.
Yeah. Well, he might be a musical himself. We don't know.
Yeah.
Harpending would soon...
Harpending?
...become one of California's...
Close with the harp. That's what my granddad always said.
He would eventually soon become one of California's main financiers.
Okay.
So in 1854, Arnold... Apparently, they made some money because he headed back to Kentucky. He bought a farm. He got married, started a family, and supposedly stashed some cash there.
Okay.
But then he came back to San Francisco to make some more dough.
All right. Sourdough.
Uh-huh. In 1870.
You like that one. You're trying to resist.
In 1870, a man named James Cooper was working as an assistant bookkeeper for the Diamond Drill Company in San Francisco. They were a drill maker that used diamond-headed bits.
Sure.
So Cooper is a bookkeeper, and he's just over 40 years old.
Okay.
He was very interested in industrial-grade diamonds that kept the drills running. He's, like, fascinated by this stuff. He went as far as to read through as much as he could on the subject, and at some point, Cooper befriended Arnold and Slack, and the cousins came into possession of a bag of uncut diamonds.
Came into possession?
Yep. It is believed...
This is like how Michael Irvin came into possession of crack. It's magical!
It's believed Cooper stole them from his employer, and then was going to go in on a little something with these two guys, and they just bailed on him.
Okay. Wow.
Arnold mixed the diamonds with garnets, rubies, and sapphires that he bought from some Indians in Arizona.
It'll be the most beautiful thing ever.
He's just making like a beautiful rock poop.
I'm going to put them all in a blender and then mush them into something, and it's going to be so beautiful.
So the cousins-
rubies and emeralds and pearls and gold and diamonds.
You should be a voice in a like Christmas special.
No, these kids won't have Christmas on my watch.
There. The cousins took
Not if I could collect all their teeth.
Okay, that's a good weird
time. Sorry.
The cousins took
So alone up here. No one visits me. I just
Who are you?
You don't even want to know.
The who?
I'm the Iceman. And nobody knows me well.
Okay. Iceman,
touch me and you'll freeze.
No, thanks.
That's the problem, you see. If I could be hugged, perhaps my cold heart would melt. Okay. But anyone who touches me also freezes.
Wow, that's a rough
Quite one. A conundrum I toil with up here alone.
Yeah, maybe you'll figure it out in 22
I always wonder, will a boy save me?
The cousins took their little bag of gems, and they went to the office of George D. Roberts, who was a prominent San Francisco businessman. Arnold had worked for Roberts previously as a prospector, so he knows the guy. He goes to him.
Okay.
Roberts was known to strike quick when a business opportunity presented itself.
Okay.
So Arnold and Slack showed up one night at Roberts' office. They had the appearance of two men who were pretty weather-beaten, right? So they looked like they've been outside a while.
Sure. A couple catchers showed up.
Arnold clutched a small leather bag. They told Roberts what was inside was of great value and that they would have deposited it in the Bank of California, but it was already closed. Then they acted suddenly like they didn't want to talk about what was in the bag.
Wait, this is too... come on. What is he like? Four?
We're just getting started. Finally, Arnold slipped and said, rough diamonds.
Okay.
Oopsie.
What are you doing?
When questioned by Roberts, they wouldn't say where they had found the diamonds, but they did let it slip that it was somewhere in Indian territory.
So, wait, they're holding back? Hey, we can't tell you what's in the bag, okay? Anyway, how you been? Rough diamonds. Oh, man, I let it slip. Oh, what are you going to do? All right, as long as we don't tell them where it's from. Of course not. Our lips are sealed. Yeah, these rough diamonds are from Indian territory. Hey, whoa!
Whoa! Oh. Quote, Roberts was very much elated by her discovery and promised Slack and myself to keep it a profound secret until we could explore
this
the country.
This guy's a hook, line, and sinker. Yeah. Now, it's very important you don't have any of those slips when talking to others, gentlemen. Good thing you did this in front of me.
Until we could explore the country further and ascertain more fully the extent of our discoveries. Arnold and Slack were good at working men, and they made... Robert swear he wouldn't tell anyone, knowing full well that he would tell everyone.
Oh, God. Also, I think anytime someone uses ascertain,
out.
I'm a little like, eh.
Those are suspicious people.
Yeah. Nobody, you can't casually say ascertain. Oh, I hadn't ascertained that.
As soon as Arnold and Slack left, Roberts told the founder of the Bank of California, William C. Ralston. Ralston is a famous West Coast money
he
man.
He just couldn't shut up.
No, fuck no. This guy's... So Ralston's a famous West Coast money man. He built hotels and mills and invested in pretty much everything, including the Comstock Lode and the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. When the Big Four who funded it ran out of money, he had thrown so much money into a silver venture in New Mexico that they named a town after him. So he's Moneybags.
Okay.
Johnson. Roberts reached out by cable to a guy he knew who was currently in London getting ready to float a stock option for the new silver venture.
When you say cable, is that what is that?
So that's how they used to communicate.
Yeah, but what is that? That's just a...
What is a cable back then? You know, I didn't even think about that when I wrote it. I don't think it's like Morse code. It's
wouldn't be Morse. Next... Yeah, that's what it... Right? Would it just be like... It's just kind of like a telegram, probably.
Maybe, but I would assume that... Let's see, 1850s. Yeah, there might be like a
short but sweet. It was like Twitter. He had 140 characters.
Yep, 140 characters. So the guy who was there in London was Asbury Harpending.
Harpending.
Quote, Ralston's description of it made Sinbad the Sailor look like a novice. He said that diamonds of incalculable value could be gathered in limitless quantities at nominal expense, that they could be picked up on anthills, that a low estimate was a $50 million proposition.
Sorry, I'm going to need a couple things cleared up. Okay. Let's start with the anthills.
Okay, so they they told him, Arnold and Slack told him that they're just
harp. Diamonds. This is harp ending. They told this to.
No, they told this to Robert. Well,
and he told it to harp ending.
Yeah.
Right.
And
okay.
He said that there's just diamonds laying around in this place and that they can just pick them up and it won't cost much money to get them out of the ground because they're easy to grab and they're going to be worth $50 million.
But that's the anthills thing? He's saying like they're in the ground?
Yeah, he's saying they're like on anthills. Like they're. Like you can
there's
just reach
that many.
In. You can just reach in and grab them.
Okay. All right. I'm going to abandon that one.
Usually a you'd
so,
mind.
So, and harp ending, he is the guy who was obsessed with the diamond like cutting, right?
Nope.
Oh, which guy is he?
That guy's gone.
Who's harp ending?
Harp ending is the guy we met at first, and he just worked with Arnold and
okay.
Slack.
All right. Gotcha.
That's all.
Okay.
So he hears this crazy story, and Ralston tells Harpending, he's like, you got to drop everything and come now. You got to come now. And Harpending's like, I'm not really, it sounds kind of. Eh.
I mean, can I bring the harp?
So he's not convinced. But then rumors of a vast diamond field in America hit London. Financiers started calling Harpending for information because he knew Ralston. Suddenly it seemed real. So what happened was, is Roberts and Ralston were fucking telling everybody, and then word got back to the guy.
It's just all nonsense, it's right?
Just, yeah. Well, we'll see.
But now just, okay.
So Harpending finally heads for San Francisco, quote, as fast as steamships and railroads would carry me.
Oh, I got there as quick as I could. 3 weeks.
He arrived.
Oh, door-to-door 3 weeks.
He arrived in 1932.
Hello, I'm old and forgot why I came.
So he arrives in San Francisco in May 1871. There he learned it was Arnold and Slack. He knew both of the men. Arnold had previously worked for Roberts, looking into mining properties, and Slack, quote, I had known as a plain man about town.
Okay.
That's not a good description.
Yeah.
He's very simple.
He's just a nobody to me.
Arnold and Slack came back from another trip to the diamond field.
Hey, let me tell you, these diamonds are even more bountiful than we originally anticipated.
They're on trees.
Yeah, and instead of ants, those are diamonds now too. So the anthills are actually diamonds.
Diamond hills.
So the ants are diamonds, and the hills diamonds, and on top of the diamonds is a diamond.
This time they told Roberts they had 60 pounds of diamonds and rubies worth $600,000.
Oh, this guy's like, oh my God. Gentlemen, let's be calm.
Roberts thought it was amazing, and he brought more people in on the deal.
Okay.
Ralston told them that a local jeweler had authenticated the diamonds.
Okay. All right.
So,
but that
now,
still doesn't corroborate whether or not you found the mother load.
So now there were Roberts, Ralston, Harpending, plus San Francisco mining entrepreneurs William Lent and General George Dodge.
Wow, those are great names.
Yeah.
Lent for a money man, a general who dodged.
They all wanted to get Arnold and Slack out of the picture by buying them out as soon as possible.
Okay, smart.
Yep.
A lose the losers real quick.
That's right. But Arnold and Slack were not down with a buyout at first. Then Slack asked for $100,000 for his share. $50,000 now, and then $50,000 the next time they came back with diamonds.
Okay.
They said they wanted to make another trip to the diamond field, and the investors could then come and see it after.
Okay.
Arnold said they would come back with a couple million dollars worth of diamonds that would send the city into a diamond madness.
I have a feeling that might be true.
And they would give the diamonds to the investors as a guarantee of good faith.
Okay. So let us go pet the dragon, and then we'll come back, and you can meet the dragon.
So the two men took the 50 grand and headed to England, where they bought uncut gems using fake names.
Okay. Wow. This is, yeah. I mean, this is definitely, this is like, you're letting it ride.
Arnold called himself Ondell, and Slack called himself Bertram.
And that is enough?
I guess. I don't think anybody's asking for ID when you're buying
diamonds. You just need
to
have a different name?
Well, you're buying diamonds in the 1850s. No one fucking cares.
I know, but it's still pretty amazing that all you have to do is be like, I'm Gus Rangus. Thanks a bunch.
So they bought $20,000 worth of rough diamonds and rubies. They bought thousands of them. The seller asked them if they wanted them cut, but they said they did not.
No, actually, make them look really shitty.
Make them look shit like they're out in the ground.
Can you throw a couple of ants on them?
Arnold and Slack went ahead to their diamond field and put the rest of the gems they'd purchased in England all over the field, and some in the ground.
Oh my God. They're Easter eggs.
They then returned and met Harpending at a train station just east of San Francisco. Harpending, quote, "Both were travel-stained and weather-beaten and had the general appearance of having gone through much hardship and privation."
Sure.
Slack was asleep, but Arnold sat grimly erect like a vigilant old soldier with a rifle by his side. Also, a bulky-looking buckskin package. Arnold Slack said they had pulled enough diamonds to fill two sacks.
Okay.
Unfortunately, one of the slacks had been dropped in a river while they were crossing on a raft.
The luck.
Well, they came back and the river had gone up and they had to build a raft.
Sure.
And it didn't work out that great and they dropped a sack of diamonds.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. Because here's one sack. How could there not be two?
They gave the sack to Harpending. When they got to Oakland, he gave them a receipt, and he headed to San Francisco on a ferry.
A receipt? A
receipt for a sack of diamonds.
Here you go.
Here you go, sack of diamonds, one.
It's a write-off.
Harpending rushed home, where the other investors were waiting.
Gentlemen, quote, I have fantastic news.
We lost one, but we got one.
Well, they dropped one in a river.
Quote, "We did not waste time on ceremonies. A sheet was spread on my billiard table. I cut the elaborate fastenings of the sack and, taking hold of the lower corners, dumped the contents. It seemed like a dazzling, many-colored cataract of light."
Yep, that'll do it.
That's what it was. They were all clearly pretty excited, but they were still businessmen.
Sure.
Clearly. So they took 10% of the gems to jeweler Charles Lewis Tiffany in New York City to be appraised.
Tiffany.
Yeah.
Sure.
Tiffany's and company. You know, yep. Lead guy.
Yeah.
They also hired a mining engineer to check out the diamond field. And to get everyone excited, they had a San Francisco jeweler put a bunch of the stones on sample in his window.
Saying that.
And it worked.
But so, sorry. So, like, what is in their delusioned brains? What do they want? Don't they want.
They're going to sell stock.
So they have this area now, this amazing area, this beautiful utopia, and they're going to sell stock and allowing people to go there.
No, they're just going to sell stock and mining it like you would if you found
oil. Oh, okay, right, okay.
You're going to create a company, sell stock.
Okay, they're going public.
Going public.
Okay.
It worked. The city was in a diamond fever, which would greatly increase the value of their investment. The investors formed a corporation and valued it at $10 million.
That's the best. I mean, that's insane. That's like a crazy starting figure today.
It's pretty close to what Uber is.
It's not. It's madness.
Yeah.
All right, so where do we want to start off? Well, let's not get crazy. How about $1 trillion? Right? I mean, we're good. We're great.
Okay, so now they went to New York, hired a lawyer, Samuel Barlow, to represent them. In October 1871,
Some of these names.
Okay.
An attorney whose name is Barlow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is what the world was.
It was easy to pass me.
Are you Tom Pass Me?
Hey, yeah.
So they go to the lawyer's house for the appraisal. Charles Lewis Tiffany was there, as well as two Civil War generals. George McClellan, who had commanded the Union Army, was there because the group thought his name would attract other investors.
This is just insane.
And General Benjamin Butler was there because he was now a U.S. representative, and they thought he could handle any legal issues in Congress if the diamond field turned out to be on federal land.
I mean, they are putting together quite a package.
Well, they're businessmen. They know what to do.
Yeah.
Fucking take the land from the people. And
they
then,
got a name. Yeah. They got someone on the inside.
Butler was nicknamed the Beast for his treatment of civilians in New Orleans during the war. So they got that guy.
Okay.
And the editor of the New York Tribune was also there. Tiffany went through the stones, which included some rubies, emeralds, and sapphires. He said, quote, "viewed them gravely and held them up to the light, looking every whit the part of a great connoisseur."
Then he delivered his verdict.
Okay.
Gentlemen, these are beyond precious stones of enormous value.
That's a bold intro.
Gentlemen, these are beyond precious. These are beyond. He could not say exactly how valuable they were until he took them back to his shop and had his guy look at them, which was done. Tiffany then reported the stones were worth $150,000.
Bought for $20,000?
$20,000, and then they threw a bunch on the ground.
So
that's quite a bit more than the $20,000 they paid.
So it's just, it's they're photocopying the BS. It's spreading further.
That's 10% of the bag.
Right.
10% of the half of the 20.
Oh, God.
Harpenning did some math and concluded the sack was worth $1.5
million.
Turns out Charles Lewis Tiffany and his, I think it's lapidary, didn't know shit about uncut stones. So they were talking out of their ass. So Tiffany basically just got cut stones, and that's what he knew how to work with.
Right.
And so he brings back to his guy, and they don't know shit about uncut diamonds.
Right.
So they just crazy overvalue it.
Right, yeah. The guy who slices meat has a cow in front of him, and he's like, how do you...
I say 9 pounds?
$1 billion, yep.
But word was now out in New York, and speculators were circling. Everyone wanted in on the investment.
Perfect.
When word reached Arnold in San Francisco, he was surprised and excited.
Yeah, what? Sorry?
I saw you said it was, what, squeeze me, 150 what?
150,000, but they think it's more, so it's like 1.5 million.
Oh, that's, yes.
You believe it? You must not be surprised, though, because you knew that.
I've been to the, no, I'm not surprised at all.
Boy, I would love to take a look at this ant farm of yours.
It's a big one. So his con now has been blessed by the most famous jeweler in the U.S., who is apparently a moron. Arnold then made a
He was probably starting to think there were maybe diamonds there.
He's like, what's
wait,
happening?
Did I miss something? Were there actual diamonds there?
So Arnold then made a stink and said he was putting his property at the mercy of others without security. Right?
Right.
Slack got his second $50,000 and Arnold got $100,000. He then headed back to London as quickly as possible, and there he bought $8,000.
Oh, God.
Of more uncut gems from the same guy.
What'd you do with the first batch, pal?
I must have dropped him in a river.
Oh, that's happening.
Now he knew he was going to have to trick the investor's well-respected mining engineer, Henry Jannon, who the corporate members had hired.
Okay.
Harpenning, quote, as a great mine expert and consulting engineer, he was without appear in the U.S., perhaps in the world. Nearly all the big operators are willing to stake their fortunes on his judgment.
So this is the test.
This is the guy. It was Jannon. It was said Jannon had examined over 600 mines and never made a mistake. So Arnold and Slack met Jannon, General Dodge, Harpenning, and an English buddy of Harpenning's in St. Louis.
Hello, I don't have a name.
I think Rewberry, that's his name.
Hello, I'm Rewberry.
Hello, Rewberry.
I'm quite fancy.
So they meet in St. Louis. There they got on a Union Pacific train to Rawlings, Wyoming. The field where they had spread out around the diamonds was close to Black Buttes, Wyoming, but Arnold wanted to keep them from knowing exactly where it was.
Right.
So he crisscrossed and winded his way on a confusing four-day horseback journey that was totally unnecessary.
With them?
Yeah. So he's taken the four guys like on this crazy journey that he could have just—they could have just gotten there in like half a day.
Right. But he wants to make sure that they have no real clue where it is. So he's like, "It's just a little further."
He kept pretending to be lost, getting off his horse and climbing a nearby hill to get his bearings. The men started to get irritated and started fighting with one another, but finally they arrived at the diamond field at about 4 o'clock on June 4th, 1872.
All right.
They immediately started looking for diamonds. Arnold started suggesting where they should dig, and by God, he was right.
Dude, this is an Easter egg hunt. This is what you do with kids on an Easter egg hunt. I can't find any. Why don't you check this bush? Check this bush here. I bet if you... Not a little further, even. Check the bush a little further.
Harpenning, quote, after a few minutes, Rewberry gave a yell. He held up something glittering in his hand. For more than an hour, diamonds were being found in profusion, together with occasional rubies, emeralds, and sapphires.
Which they're just throwing aside. Get these stupid rubies out of here.
This went on for 2 days.
They're just having diamond orgasms for 2 days.
The mining engineer, Janin, lost his shit.
Oh, no.
Besides being given a $2,500 fee for his services, the investor said he could purchase 1,000 shares of stock in the Diamond New Venture for $10 a share.
And his eyes bugged out of his head.
Janin was, quote, wildly enthusiastic. He was saying his name should be associated with the most momentous discovery of the age.
Oh, wow. Poor guy.
Because he thought the surrounded area could also have gems, Janin staked out 3,000 acres. So now he's just going everywhere.
He's all in.
But the gems were just located on 1 acre.
It's so weird. What do you think was special about the acre?
I don't know. In his report, so Janin wrote a report. He wrote that the proposed 100,000 shares of stock were easily worth $40 each.
Oh, jeez. Oh, boy.
So it started out as 10. He also pointed out that this new field would certainly control the gem market of the world. After they were done, the group headed back.
The cousins must be like, this is good, but this is going maybe too good.
Are people really this? I mean, like,
this will change the way world handles finance. No, dude, chill.
I thought we were going to make like 20 grand.
I'll buy 300,000 acres. No. Think about it. If they're all as populous as this, we'd be fools not to.
So after they're done, like 3 or 4 days or whatever, they head back. And they left Slack and the English guy, Rubery, to guard the site. But Rubery and Slack hated each other, so they just bailed and went their separate ways.
Okay, good.
No one ever heard from Slack again.
Okay.
Well, he got a fucking 100,000.
Yeah.
Right?
Every reason. Yeah. And he's on a lie.
Well.
On a hunch.
Back in San Francisco, Arnold got another $150,000 from the investors, as per their agreement. He also immediately sold his stock to Harpening, which gave him more than $300,000.
Ugh.
Now his total haul was $550,000, which is about $8 million in today's money.
It's so much.
Even though he still had more shares coming his way, he figured he was testing his luck, so he bailed and went back to Kentucky to live with his family.
Yeah, honestly, at that point, you're like, yeah, deal.
Bye, bye.
Yep.
Investors were fine with it, Lent said.
Well, they were probably like, what a fool.
Janin told him they could pull $1 million worth of diamonds a month with just 20 laborers.
Oh, God.
It's like when you pick apples, except it's diamonds.
Ugh. And that he's like the guy to go to, and he's buying it more than anyone.
Yeah. 25 men, the top financial guys in San Francisco, were then allowed to buy stock in the company at $80,000 each.
Wow.
$2 million was placed into the Bank of California. Not a share of stock was placed on the market. Quote, although the excitement was intense, all the papers were running stories. Clarence King was born in Rhode Island on January 6th, 1842. His father traded goods with China and spent a lot of time away from the family. He then died in 1848, so Clarence was raised by his mother. As a child, he became interested in the great outdoors and natural history. His mother encouraged him in these endeavors, as did his local reverend. And when he was 10, he went to schools in Boston and New Haven. And at 13, he was accepted to the prestigious Hartford High School. From there, he went to Sheffield Scientific School, which is part of Yale.
Okay.
He then graduated with a Ph.B.
Sorry.
Peanut
is
ham
that the
and butter.
PhD you get at the 99-cent store?
Peanut ham and butter.
PhD.
It's I think it's a philosophy degree.
It's I mean, we're just very conditioned to PhD. No,
I get it.
No hate on a PhD, but
then he and some friends
definitely sounds like something a doctor gives his kid on take your kid to work day.
Have some PhD, buddy.
You're a PhD, my man.
King and some friends took a Yale rowboat for the summer and rowed up along the shores of Lake Champlain and some Canadian rivers. After he was at the home of a professor, when he heard a letter read aloud by a dude who had just climbed Mount Shasta, suddenly he had an interest in geology.
Okay.
In 1863, King and two friends took the rails to Missouri, then hopped a wagon train and went to Carson City, Nevada.
Okay.
Eventually, he found himself in California, where he got a job with the California Geological Survey, but without the being paid part.
Okay.
He got a free job.
Sure. Well, they got a free worker.
He got a free job.
Sure. Yep. His job was free.
I have a job.
Yep. You didn't have to pay for it.
Right.
Suckers.
They climbed many peaks in the West, mapping as they went. He named Mount Whitney.
Okay.
In 1864, King and a friend were appointed to make a boundary survey of Yosemite Valley. Next, he and his friend were given a job of surveying the Mojave Desert and Arizona. When his stepfather died, he came back to the East Coast, where he lobbied Congress to pay him to survey the Great Basin region. He got federal funding and was named U.S. Geologist of the Geological Exploration of the 40th Parallel. So now he's just fucking mapping. So there, he puts together a team of three dozen men. And for over 6 years, explored the West from Eastern California to Wyoming, 80,000 square miles.
So he kind of knows things.
He knows some shit.
Sure.
Around this time, just as the survey is almost done, King found himself on a train with some of his men and an engineer named Jannon.
Okay. Oh, boy.
Jannon was returning from a diamond field.
And probably wouldn't shut up. Boy, you're not going to believe it.
Look at my bucket.
Honestly.
Look at my bucket. I got a fancy rocks.
And they got more than the eye could see.
It's fucking crazy.
I'm all in. If this were to collapse, my life would be devastated.
Hey, I'm all in.
I'm all in. Jannon is all Jan in.
One of Clarence's crew, geologist Samuel F. Emmons, wrote that, quote, suspicious-looking characters on the train are returning diamond hunters. Harry Jannon shows us some of the diamonds. Pretty crystals. Clarence's team had heard of the diamond fever that was hitting the West, but most of the rumors had come out of Arizona and New Mexico, which was outside of his survey. Now he found out that the diamond field was supposed to be in the Northwest, in his survey area. This was not far from where geologist Emmons had been working. So this was a concern for Clarence. A huge discovery of diamonds would be a problem for his survey and call into question how thorough he and his crew had been.
Right.
Which may cause those in Congress who were against funding the job to cut off their money.
Right. Okay.
So Clarence King and his crew decided they had to check out the diamond field as soon as possible. Clarence Emmons and a third man headed for Fort Bridger, Wyoming, 2 weeks later. They went there because they had already boarded some mules there for the winter. Back in San Francisco, Jannon, having clearly just had an interesting conversation with some geologists on a train, sold all of his shares.
Wow. Wow. What a great talk.
Making a sweet $30,000.
Hey, all right. Somebody's laughing all the... Oh, my God. So how much is he in the hole?
Who?
Jannon.
Oh, Jannon's out. He's made tons of money. I mean,
oh, he did?
Yeah, at this point he's made $32,500, and then on top of that,
so he just sold that immediately, but still made money.
Yeah, he was given shares or allowed to buy shares.
1,000 shares, I thought you said.
Well, he made $30,000 above his fee. So,
okay,
so he made
a good amount of money.
30 on top plus his. Plus,
but he left the train and he was like, oh yeah, I'm still really into it. Hey, I want to get out. Yeah, no, it's awesome. I think, like, wow. I mean, we're gonna make so much money, you guys. But I gotta cash it out.
My dog's sick, so I gotta
call
big
it.
Bill coming.
I gotta
in.
Get out of here. I gotta
go.
You know, whatever you guys look at me right now, whatever
Come
you on. Have on you, work
go.
Fine.
I gotta
get
just
moving.
Blink and we got a deal. Blink,
I
we
am
got a deal.
Just very, very happy to be a part of such a great deal.
Okay, throw money down.
All
right. Cash.
I'll take $8. I'm not kidding. I just want to walk.
A week and a half later, King and his two buddies started a 150-mile journey to where they had deduced the site was from speaking to Jannon, their own field work, and other clues. So they fucking put it together.
Yeah.
That's how smart these
fuckers
are.
They're like, that took you 4 days?
They traveled through brutally cold conditions. After five days, they set up camp and started looking around. It didn't take them long to find a posted claim notice by Jannon.
Okay.
They then followed other posted notices until they came, quote, upon a bare iron-stained bit of coarse sandstone rock about 100 feet long.
Okay.
Throwing down our bridle reins, we began examining the rock on our hands and knees, and in another instant, I had found a small ruby. This was indeed the spot. The diamond fever had now attacked us with vigor, and while daylight lasted, we continued in this position, picking up precious stones. And when a diamond was found, it was quite a time before our benumbing fingers could succeed in grasping it, because it was so cold.
Right.
When they went to sleep that night, they were dreaming of how wealthy they would be. But the next day, King realized that whenever he found a diamond, he also found a dozen rubies. It was a bit too perfect for it to be occurring naturally. Also, most of the gems were found only in disturbed ground, and it got worse. Rubies found in anthills were surrounded by footprints.
Oh, my God. I mean, they're lazy.
And, quote, besides the top hole by which the ants made their exit, there was visible in the side another small break in the crust.
Okay.
So they slide them in the side.
Yeah, it's pretty standard.
Anthills that did not have footprints or broken crusts did not have rubies.
Weird.
Quote, our explanation was that someone must have pushed a ruby in or two on the end of a stick. They spent days doing more tests, which included digging a trench 10 feet deep in a gulch where diamonds should have been disturbed well below the surface, but there were no diamonds in it. Then on the fourth day, a man rode up on a horse.
Okay.
He was, quote, a stout party, city dressed, and looking very much out of keeping with his surroundings. Have you found any carrots around here? The man asked. One of the crew said it was a fraud, and the man responded, quote, what a chance to sell short on the stock.
Wait.
He's saying this is a good time to sell.
Yeah. So he literally is like, if you wrote him in a movie, people would be like, that's too on the nose.
He turned out to be J.F. Barry. He was a New York diamond dealer who had followed King's party from Fort Bridger and had been watching them with a spyglass from the top of the nearby bluffs.
This guy is badass.
So he knows about the diamond. He knows about the diamond fever. He knows that they were out there somewhere. He goes to this fucking place. He sees these guys come out and he follows them.
And then he's also like, so it is BS.
So it's all shit. Clarence then decided to go to San Francisco, find out the status of the company, and prevent any further selling of stock. He also wanted to get there before Barry could get back and tell everyone of the fraud first. So he wants credit.
Right.
Who wouldn't? So Clarence left camp well before dawn, rode the 45 miles to Black Butte Station, got on a train, and then arrived in San Francisco on November 10th. He went straight to Janin's hotel and spent the night explaining in detail what they had found and convinced Janin he was right and it was a fraud. The next morning, King and Janin met the investors at Ralston's office at the Bank of California.
So, we got good news? What's happening? And let me tell you one thing before you get into it. We've been like kids on Christmas. Okay. I can't wait to hear the good news.
Okay.
Now, Dish. We are excited.
Okay.
Should we light the cigars now?
Wait.
Let's light them now. Come on, light them. Hand the lighter around. All right. Okay. All right. Shh. Shut up. Hit us with the good news.
He said that the diamond seals were utterly, utterly valueless, and that they had been victims of unparalleled fraud.
What's the good news?
And he read them a letter that he had written that was to be published with all this information. He explained the tests he and his men had done.
Sure.
And the investors were, quote, astonished and thrown into utter consternation.
Okay, let's not, let's everybody not freak out. Okay.
Hold on now.
There's a lot of good that can,
But I'm Ralston. Whatever I put my money into turns into gold.
Oh, damn it.
One of the men told King he could gain financially if he were to sit on the news for a day and not tell anyone.
I mean, that's game over, dude. One more hit.
King responded, quote, there is not enough money in the Bank of California to make me delay publication a single hour.
We have more money.
The men then agreed to stop the planned sale of 100,000 shares of stock at $100 a share. So people have gone so bug-fuck. Were,
okay.
$100 a share.
Yeah.
$100,000. Like,
I mean,
at that point.
Game, like.
I mean.
Oil money.
It's insane. The whole economy would be based on
this. Yeah, a diamond.
At that point, they talked King into leading another party, including Jannon, back to the field. The group set out the next day. When they arrived at the Not Diamond Field, it was so cold that one man's whiskey was frozen in the bottle. General David Cotton, who had become general manager of the company 3 weeks before, inspected with King and reported back to the investors that he had seen rubies scattered on Bear Rock where, quote, it would have been impossible for nature to have deposited them as for a person standing in San Francisco to toss a marble in the air and have it fall on Bunker Hill.
He
could have said that.
Just once. Get to it.
He could have said that a lot.
So what? It's fake or not? Well, like I'm saying, it would be far easier to find. If you want to look for diamonds, you'd have a better chance having a picnic on a fired cannonball.
Or putting a hair on the moon.
Yeah, exactly. So, any questions?
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Okay. You would have a better chance throwing a snowball onto a train headed for Tallahassee.
Are there diamonds there?
I'm answering your question.
No, you're not.
I'm creating a parallel. Now, you want to know if there are diamonds there, right?
When you were a general, did you win any battles?
No, but everyone had diarrhea one day. Okay. Now, listen.
Okay.
Now, wait. You'd have a better chance putting a checker on an ostrich who's going to Phoenix.
Okay, so I'm going to assume it's not real.
That's my point to you. That's the point I'm making to you.
I'm going
to
shoot you in the face.
Well, you'd have a harder chance shooting me than you would putting a bullet in your mouth and spitting it through a drain spout.
Okay.
Like we always said where I'm from.
General, you're fired.
Well, I don't believe I was ever hired, to be totally honest with everyone.
So after the investors got the report and heard Jannon try to explain why he had been so wrong, they voted to publish King's letter.
Hard, no eye contact in that moment.
None.
So I'm totally way off, I guess.
I was so fired up when I got there.
This is tough.
But again, remember, this is a time where there's not a lot of education. People just say they are. Like, King, who is now this crazy awesome geologic surveyor, didn't have any actual training in that.
Right.
He got a philosophy degree and learned out there in the... So... I don't know. Who knows what kind of education Jannon had in engineering? Or if he was just a guy who went into a hole.
Well, he was excitable.
So they voted to publish King's letter and dissolve the company. The San Francisco Chronicle on November 26 had a huge headline, Unmasked, followed by The Great Diamond Fiasco, The Mammoth Fraud Exposed. Jannon was the only swindler to profit. Only swindled to profit.
I don't know if you call him swindled at that point.
Yeah. Since Arnold and Slack were long gone, the reporters focused on the victims. Because the victims were all rich millionaires, the papers mocked them as gullible. Jannon was torn apart in the press for being a so-called mining engineer who was so easily fooled.
Miming engineer.
The papers then turned on Harpending as being suspected of being one of the con men, because he was reported to have been in London at the time of one of Arnold's diamond buying sprees.
Ooh.
So the first time he bought diamonds.
Yeah, Harpending was there.
It was discovered that General Butler picked up 1,000 shares of stock for pushing a mining act through Congress that allowed the company to buy the federal land that held the diamond fields. So he's in trouble.
I mean, boy, it must have been a fun run. When you were able to be like, hey, this guy took money. So let's talk about it.
And people are like, no.
Yeah.
William Lent lost $350,000 and Ralston lost
$250,000.
Clarence King was a hero. The Chronicle editorialized that we have escaped, thanks to God and Clarence King, a great financial calamity. They were right.
That's pretty cool when your partner's God.
The interest was so high in the diamond mine that they would have sold tons of stock. Harpending said, quote, it would have caused a catastrophe almost without parallel in the civilized world. The public was keyed up to the point of speculative craze such as even the Comstock never saw, not alone in San Francisco, but in nearly every financial sector on Earth. Millions upon millions would have been invested. That's weird. I wonder if that relates to anything. A lot of people.
No.
A lot of people saw this as the government acting on behalf of the people. People, because King worked for the government, and he was expertly informed, incorruptible, and smarter than the greedy rich. No one ever found out what became of John Slack. It was believed he left the country or died soon after leaving the diamond fields. But in 1967, Bruce A. Woodard, an accountant who had become obsessed with the hoax, wrote that Slack had taken a job building caskets in St. Louis and eventually moved to White Oaks, New Mexico, where he became an undertaker living alone until he died at 76 in 1896. He left behind an estate of $1,600. So he... I didn't put this in here, but he went to St. Louis and opened up this casket building company, which eventually either burned down or something happened to it.
Okay.
And he was out of all his money, and then he moved.
Jeez.
That's what happened to that fella. He died. He died.
Can't you just easily switch it to a crematorium at that point?
Oh, yeah. Arnold did.
What did you think? You got coffins? I was never doing that.
No. I'm burning stuff here.
Yeah.
Arnold did okay. In July 1872, he bought a two-story brick house in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and moved his family into it. He bought 500 acres nearby and bred horses, sheep, and pigs. He put everything in his wife's name.
Smart.
Smart.
Yeah.
Smartest guy. A grand jury in San Francisco indicted Arnold and Slack for fraud, but the contents of the indictment were never revealed. It is believed the investors didn't want any more embarrassing publicity, especially the kind a trial would bring, and they quashed the indictment. When Arnold was told of the indictments by a Louisville paper, he said he had retained his own counsel, a good Henry Rifle. But Arnold eventually did settle out of court with William Lent. He gave him $150,000.
Oh, wow.
This was the closest he came to acknowledging he had planted diamonds. Still, he was seen as a hero in the area, a man who had taken from the rich after the devastation suffered by the South in the war. It was around that it was found that in 1870, Arnold and Slack... it was found that in 1870, Arnold and Slack had made a couple of lucky turns selling mines and had made over $50,000, which they had in a bank. The deposit was withdrawn in bulk and was traced in the purchase of diamonds in the markets of Amsterdam and London. They bought them from many different businesses to not raise suspicion, and that was their initial stake. The next time Arnold went there, he just walked into one business and asked to see their diamonds and said, how much for the lot?
Mm-hmm.
In 1873, Arnold got into the banking game when he invested in a local bank that had temporarily closed its doors. 5 years later, he got into a disagreement with another bank in town, which led to a shootout.
Whoa.
Put your money in our bank and we'll fucking kill the other guys.
I mean,
I love two banks shooting it out.
Yeah.
The best thing that's ever happened.
Chase just shot BOA. What?
Let them fight.
Truly, right? I mean, that's the first thing you think.
I would let BOA and Chase kill each other.
Yeah. Wells Fargo, break it up. And you also shoot.
Three bystanders were wounded, and Arnold was shot by a shotgun blast in the shoulder. He survived. 6 months later, though, he came down with pneumonia and died at the age of 49. His family was left well off, though several hundred thousand dollars have never been accounted for. King became an international celebrity as the whole affair was followed in London and New York. His book, even today, is considered a classic of American nature writing. He was friends with people like Henry Adams, John Hay, and Henry James. Hay called Clarence King the best and brightest man of his generation. King returned to the East Coast after a survey and published a book based on his work called Systematic Geology in 1878, which one critic called the most important single contribution made to the scientific knowledge of the continent. But even Clarence King fell under the spell of money. He tried ranching, mining, and even banking, but he didn't have the mind for any of them. He lost more money than he made, and he lost the money of many of his friends as well. He eventually died deep in debt of tuberculosis in a small brick house in Phoenix in 1901. He was 59. His friend Teddy Roosevelt sent a wire of condolences from the White House.
Wow.
Even the fucking smart guy died broke. And,
yeah.
Because he was trying to be rich. Yeah. How about the story? Is you just have a job and have fun.
No, yeah. It's like The Ring.
Everyone's got to be rich.
Yeah. Once you see it, you're like, wait.
I got it.
But the sirens sing loudly for me. Different this time. Yeah.
And that it would have imploded the international economic, like it, the whole system would have collapsed.
Well, and for those of us who go, hey, what would that look like? You know, potentially good news on the way.
It ends with Trump.
Yeah, potentially you might be able to actually see what happens when in America they're like, no, no, now you guys use yen. And we're like, what? No, you guys use yen now. Oh, so, we do? Yeah.
I didn't know we did that.
Well, our plan is that we're going to put up a big fence around where we live, and you guys will figure out your new yen economy.
All right.
All right, we'll be in Elysium. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye. Close that hatch door. Close the hatch door. I don't want to look at him anymore. Close the hatch.
We sell diamonds. Sign diamonds?
We sign diamonds.
We sell diamonds.
And potentially soon we'll be decaling cars with our diamond signatures.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Soon.
Miss you.
Miss you, man. Miss you, man.